Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 14th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Dorothy Bass. Today's session number is 98-1, and it's titled, Practicing Our Faith. It's About Time. Let's listen in.
Forgiving, giving hospitality to strangers, these are things that for centuries Christian people have done together to address fundamental human needs in a way that responds to our knowledge that God is active and present in our lives and in the lives of the world. So practices like these are deeply shaped by what we believe. We believe, for instance, that God created the world and gave us hospitality to dwell within. We believe that our ancestors were strangers and that therefore we should honor and welcome strangers, and so on. Each practice embeds and embodies some beliefs, but they're also very practical. They involve sharing food with people. They involve having a bed in which to offer someone rest. They involve touch and care. They involve taking someone's temperature and putting a cool cloth on their head. Practices involve down-to-earth, very concrete activities. And we learn to do them with other people, and when we do them together, we believe we are participating in our own way in the healing that God intends for people and the hospitality that God intends for those who are lost. So there are things that we do them in relation to God and for the sake of the world. Well, we do them together. So Craig and I then invited 11 other people, some of whom we were already friends with and all of whom we would soon become friends with, to join us in thinking about this whole idea of the practices that shape our life as Christians. And two of the people whom we invited are Amy Planting a Pow, who preached last night and who is teaching on practices now as well this week here at Holden, and Ana Maria Pineda, who is another one of the teachers resident in the village right now. Several of the other authors have also been to Holden this summer or will come soon. And there's a very ecumenical group. One Lutheran, Larry Rasmussen, who was here a couple weeks ago. Three Catholics. I'm a United Church of Christ minister. There were a couple Presbyterians. There was a bishop in the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, which is one of the historically black denominations, and so on. So it was a very ecumenical group, and we're so pleased to have been able to produce something that brings those different our different church bodies together in this way. So the 12 of us then had to figure out what 12 practices we wanted to describe. And not just to describe in an abstract way, but to advocate, to urge you to think about in your own lives, to say, let's see if we can all grow stronger in these practices, which are essential for the flourishing of human life. And we sorted it. We made our list of 12 and debated this and that. And we came up with a list which you can find in the book. Each chapter includes biblical material, a theology, a sense of what God is about in this practice, some examples of how it appears in churches in history and around the world, a sense of how a practice can become distorted. What is it that drives us to inhospitality, for example? Or when can our hospitality become self-serving and deceitful? We're aware that we do these practices as sinners still. We also explore in each chapter how we learn in worship about these practices, how we celebrate them in our worship services. And there also are images and bits of poems and hymns and so on in each chapter. I think it's fair to say also that each practice has a dimension of personal faith development, but also a dimension of social justice. So that, for instance, when you think about hospitality, what does it mean to be a hospitable person? That's a deeply personal and spiritual question. to be a hospitable person who has space for others. And yet, hospitality also extends into issues of justice, sharing with the poor, immigration policy. So practices integrate this division that often happens between that which is social and justice-oriented and that which is personal and spiritual, and brings them back together. Well, when we had almost finished drafting the book, we thought we had a final manuscript. We called together each one of us 13, invited a friend who was someone in ministry or someone who we thought would be an ideal reader of the book or user of the book to come and read it and tell us what they thought and help us make it better. And they told us what they thought. We rewrote it all again after that. But the friend I invited was Susan Briel, who's one of the directors of Holden Village. And because I had been to Holden many times, and Holden had shaped my own sense of a Christian way of life, there's a high degree, I think, of thoughtfulness and intentionality about the practices that shape the life of this community. We think about the care of creation in how we deal with our garbage, right? We think about why we would eat this kind of food rather than that kind of food, right? We think about the shape of the week and the keeping of Sabbath here. There's a Not to say that it's perfect, not to say that Holden won't make many improvements in the future, but there's a thoughtfulness about the practices that are woven together into a way of life here, which I found very inspiring, and hope that Susan would see some connection between this and the life of Holden and this book. She did indeed, and said this would be a good theme book for a program year. And so here we are now in 1998, the Winter Community having studied the book, and a summer theme has grown out of our collaboration on this. Susan also became one of the collaborators, one of the six of us who wrote together a guide for conversation, learning, and growth, which accompanies the book and would help you use it in a small group or other setting. So, we are very clear that the 12 practices that we have treated are not the only practices that could be, and we don't claim to have given the final word on any of them, but the point is to invite you and other people who come across this way of thinking to think deeply about the practices as they already exist in your own life, because they probably do in some way. Each one of them exists in your life somewhere, and then how to grow stronger and to find communities that can help grow stronger in practices. Well, that's enough with the introduction about the book, and I'll move on to thinking about a single practice. Thinking about practices gets interesting when it comes down to really choosing one, getting into it, and being challenged perhaps to alter our way of life as we perceive what is called for in living this practice faithfully in our own context. So when we think about any practice, we're thinking, what are the faithful forms of this practice today in our lives and in our community? Now, the chapter that I contributed to the book was called Keeping Sabbath. And we're thinking a lot about Sabbath at Holden this summer. Each Saturday evening, that's the theme of the worship service. When the 12 authors were dividing up the practices, I was ready to arm wrestle anybody to get this one. There was just something, and I wanted to do this so much. And I think that came to me really because, you know, I'm a working mom. My life is full. It's too full. I can sometimes go, you know, just work right through the week. And if it's not school work, it might be laundry. You know, if it's not laundry, it might be shopping. You know, there's just so much to do. And, you know, both my husband and I are employed, and we had elementary school age kids at that time. And, you know, life is full, right? people are nodding, yes. and just the word Sabbath at that point, which I hadn't researched yet, just, aha, that's something I need to investigate. And investigating the biblical roots and the Christian and Jewish forms of this practice has made a difference in my own life, I think, and in the life of our family. Though I'm not by any means a strict or exemplary keeper of this practice, it has made a difference. But in the months since the book appeared, I've also come to realize in conversations with others and in my own thinking that Sabbath is just one piece of what Christian faith has to offer us in terms of orienting ourselves faithfully within time and how we spend our time and where we are in time. The weekly rhythm of Sabbath is one piece of that, but it's just one piece. I think we have a fundamental human need to know what time it is. You know, in a very deep sense, what time is it? Quick story from my kids. I try not to use cute kids' stories too often, but this is one. When my daughter Martha was about, she must have been three, she looked up from her cereal one morning and said, "Mommy, what time is it?" And I said, "Oh, it's 7 o'clock. No. Well, it's breakfast time. No. Morning. No. That wasn't right. She said, "Halloween all finished, Christmas all finished, Valentine all finished. What time is it?" What time is it? You don't want to miss anything, do you? And if you think about the speed at which our culture now is living, this race, you know, especially as the global economy moves in upon us, our economy moves out to encompass the globe, perhaps, is a better way to put it. The sense of the marketplace that never closes and the desire that has been fostered in us and our children for constant entertainment that goes on around the clock with cable channels and, you know, it's as if we're living in a 24-hour arcade in certain parts of our society more than others, I'm sure, but this is the potential. This potential that time is really out of whack in our culture. Okay? There are economic reasons for this, there are social reasons, but time is a problem. And yet time, I think, the shape of time, the knowing what time it is one of the most fundamental building blocks of meaning and of identity in any human culture. And I have 5 points to suggest why time is so important in anyone's way of life. Okay. First, a quotation from a prominent cultural anthropologist, Edward Hall. He wrote a book about time, an anthropologist, called The Silent Language. "Time talks," he says, and this is the first sentence. "It speaks more plainly than words. The message it conveys comes through loud and clear. Because it is manipulated less consciously, it is subject to less distortion than the spoken language. Time can shout the truth where words lie." Time can shout the truth where words lie. How do we spend our time? And what does this say? It's silent, but what does it say? How do we spend our time? I think he's suggesting as an anthropologist that if you went in and observed a society and how it ordered its time, you would learn a lot about what it thinks is true. And I think that's right. I think that's right. An example from history of this truth, at the time of the French Revolution, when the leaders of the revolution were really very hostile to the church, which had been in alliance with the king and the nobility and so on before the revolution, they started the calendar over with year one of the revolution. Right? You know this? 1793 or something they out. Is that right? They started off with year one. And moreover, and they renamed all the months, and they put France, they tried to put France on a 10-day week. On a 10-day week. Why? Because as long as Sunday was there, you couldn't get rid of Christianity. I suppose as long as Saturday was there, you couldn't get rid of Judaism. You know? That rhythm was there, and they felt they had to crush that rhythm in order to create a new revolutionary society that was different than the old medieval order. There was incredible popular resistance to this, and it failed. I wondered if it was because this meant only one day of rest in 10 rather than in 7. You know, this may have been kind of, and maybe for that, Stalin, I think, tried a different system, which was a 5-day rotation of weeks. As an effort, a deep cultural effort to reform a people. So there's the first point. Secondly, time, ordering time in a certain way enables us to share life and activities with other people. You have to, the bell at Holden rings, and we know it's time to do whatever the next thing is, right? And there's a clock behind the bell that tells people when to ring it. And it's because we have these ways of coming together at certain times that we can be together. You know, it's hard otherwise. Easter is the whole disputes in the history of the church over the date of Easter. Do you know that there have been schisms and all kinds of controversies in the centuries of the church's life over what date Easter should be celebrated? And there still is a schism between the Roman and the Western church and Eastern Orthodoxy over the date of Easter. And yet, I read in the Christian Century that there's a strong effort, looks like it will succeed, to bring those two celebrations together as recognition of the new millennium in 2000, is that right, or 2001, something like that. So being together, sharing time together means being together, in a sense. It's a fundamental basis of togetherness in corporate work. Third, culture is very much influenced by the shape of time among us. Now partly that is special events that happen, Easter for example, but, and for instance, I was talking to Carmen and Zarco and Anna Maria, they're planning a session on the Day of the Dead. Well, I don't know what the Day of the Dead is. I've heard of it, but I said, what day is that? November 2nd. Okay, they know this. It's a cultural thing in the Hispanic community, which they shared and shaped their culture. I was an outsider to it. There's a fascinating, one of the most interesting books I've read recently is by a social psychologist named Robert Levine. It's called The Geography of Time. And he traveled around the world a whole year and studied time in different cultures. And he said he had been told before, but he really thinks it's true, that when you go from one culture to the other, the pace and speed and expectations about time are the most disorienting thing. Mm-hmm. Not language, not food, mm-hmm. not manners, but the whole sense of time. It just deeply informs a culture. Some people are not. And you know, there are cultural divisions, even within this country, around the pace of time and speed. And my husband and I, most of our arguments about this. You know, he's from German stock, I'm from sort of English Southern, a little bit more relaxed. But that's a really, as shaping culture in some very, very strong ways, I think time is very important that way too. But there are some bigger reasons as well, and you'll notice I have scripture in front of me. Time is important because it's limited. We do not have all the time in the world, do we, as human beings? I have turned to Psalm 90, which includes one of the more famous verses about time, which I'll get to in a moment. But this psalm really is a reflection on this problem. And I'm going to read the first few verses, and I'd like you to tell me the name of a famous hymn that rephrases this passage. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting you are God. You turn us back to dust and say, turn back, you mortals. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night. Isaac Watts rephrased this. Mm-hmm. Oh God, our help in ages past. 1,000 ages in your sight are but a evening gone. Right? We fly forgotten as the night, as a dream or whatever it is. Okay. Now, this psalm continues in that mode. In fact, gets even more kind of scary about it. We're turned to dust. We're under God's wrath. But then has a turning point when the psalmist says, you know, having said all this about God's eternity and our limitation, our mortality, the psalmist says, so teach us to count our days that we may gain a wise heart. So teach us to count our days that we may gain a wise heart. I take that to mean teach us to count our days within this context of God's eternity and our finitude, and that in that will lie wisdom. I mean, knowing that our days are not limitless will be a part of wisdom. And yet, in comfort, we also see that God's eternity will hold us fast. That God has been our dwelling place is also part of this psalm. Fifth, now, God is our dwelling place. There's an eternal God who is our dwelling place here in this psalm. But unlike some other spiritual movements, Christianity is one which does not invite us to escape into eternity right now, okay, to seek to rise above our time and space in 1998. But rather one which wants to be faithfully lived out within the time that we have. And there we could find so many scriptural examples of how Christian people, faithful people in the First and the Later Testament are called into time. But, you know, when Quirinius was governor of Syria, right, the birth of Bethlehem, it's historical, we're in time. Later on in the second chapter of Luke, and his family went up to Jerusalem every year for Passover. It's kind of a regular, timely quality to that. And so he went to the synagogue, as was his custom. You know, and there's a certain patterning that is there, and certainly life in real time, not the religious life as an escape from time. So adding up all these points, I think that the importance of time in shaping our identity and the culture that we share is just really important. And I'm left wondering what truth our own practices of ordering time speak about us, if that's the silent language, what is spoken. How does the way that we shape our time remind us of our own mortality, shape us in wisdom, and keep us mindful of the needs of others and the needs of the world? Now I'm saying this, I'm using this ambiguous word, we. How does it shape us? I'm sure it happens differently for many different people. Class, age, culture make a big difference. But let me explore a couple of we's, okay? One, what is happening in North American culture generally as a crisis in time? When I say what's going on in time for us, I think part of it is a large cultural crisis in time. And secondly, we as church, what kind of time do we have? What kind of time do we know? And to get first into the culture, here's a quotation from one of our cultural spokesmen and gurus, Bill Gates. And this was in Time magazine, which did a cover story on Bill Gates, and they asked him, he's talking about his marriage. He just had been married to someone named Melinda. Melinda is Catholic, goes to church, and wants to raise their new daughter in that way. quote, "But she offered me a deal," says Gates. "If I start going to church," my family was Congregationalist, "then Jennifer could be raised in whatever religion I choose." Gates admits that he is tempted because he would prefer that his daughter have a religion that has less theology and all than Catholicism. But he has not yet taken up the offer. Just in terms of allocation of time resources, religion is not very efficient, he explains. There's a lot more I could be doing on a Sunday morning. Okay? And what, there's so many things that are intriguing there, but and I know other people who've said there's so many things, I'm too busy to go to church, you know. But this sense of time as something to be used, you know, as an allocation of time resources to an end beyond itself, a sense of what I would call utilitarian approach to time, as opposed to time as a gift, which I think we know in faith that the days that we have are given as gift. How can we reframe from time as something that we use and something that uses us almost sometimes, you know, to time as a gift? Now we could just say, well, shape up, you know it's a gift, right? Stop, don't be like Bill Gates. Go to church, right? But that's kind of a pull yourself up by the bootstraps approach to moral reformation, you know what I mean? And I don't think we can just make that switch like that. I think the shift to seeing time as gift and to living time in a way that does not make it a allocation of resources, but rather an expression of faith, lies in engaging in practices, shared acts that speak the truth that we have been given in Christ. Through these practices with other people, we not only would find order for our time, do find order for our time, but order of a kind that expresses our deepest convictions about God and ourselves and transforms us to be more able to care for others and for creation. Example, the Sabbath, okay, which I've written about extensively, just a brief little précis. When you study scripture on the meaning of Sabbath, there are, in the Old Testament, the commandment is given twice. One of them commands Sabbath keeping, for God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh he rested, okay? There and made it holy, therefore you shall rest. So in other words, there's a commending of Sabbath as a acknowledgement that God created the world, not you, that creation is a gift of which you are a part and which you are to enjoy, okay, and see yourself as part of creation, with creation, okay, and a sense of time spent with God as a holy and wonderful thing. Okay. There's a nurturing of creation, I think, that grows out of this form of Sabbath keeping. In Deuteronomy, we're commanded to keep the Sabbath because the Lord your God led you out of the house of Egypt, led you out of bondage. Okay? And every time you keep the Sabbath, you should remember that you were a slave and now you're free. Slaves can't take off a day, free people can. So there's a liberation motif in Sabbath as I read it in that text. There's a resistance to slavery. Slaves can't take a day off, including slaves who are high-powered lawyers, okay? Or including slaves who are moms who can't just let the house be for a minute, you know? Whatever the form of slavery is, there is a resistance to slavery in keeping Sabbath. And then also going into the time when Christianity became a distinct religion from Judaism, and gradually the Sabbath became celebrated on the day of the resurrection rather than on the seventh day of the week. This was a celebration each Sabbath of God's victory over death, a breaking in of the new creation of the future on the eighth day. So there are embedded in this day some deep, deep convictions about who created the world, about what that God intends for people in terms of liberation, and about the victory of life over death and the future that is breaking in upon us. This is an example. Now, there seems to me that the other ways of thinking about time within the tradition that they're equal, very rich possibility for us as we think about ordering our time are the year. Okay, how does the shape of the year express and give shape to and embody what we know in faith about God, God's intentions for us in Christ? Think about it. Advent and Christmas and Epiphany and Lent. I mean, if you've practiced the year, there are certain parts of the faith and of yourself that you can't avoid. I mean, you're called to repentance. You have a wilderness time, right? There is embedded in this heritage of practices that we do over the course of a year, almost a summary of our faith story, which we live through in a way that joins our own lives to that, again and again, year after year. And the day is another piece of time that I think people have thought about a lot in the history of the Christian tradition. In the biblical world, days begin in the evening, and then the evening and the morning, the first day. A 24-hour period goes from sundown around till the next sundown. Okay? I think that this emphasizes, at least in Jewish thought, there's a lot of emphasis on this, and I think it's very wise that this emphasizes the quality of the day as a gift, that it begins in darkness, and God is out there growing the wheat, right, and or healing the fever, or, you know, yeasting the bread or whatever while we're sleeping. We don't have to jump start each day. Each day is not about jump starting. It's about joining in to the world's work which has already been begun and which God is carrying on even while we sleep. And we mark this time with prayer, with waking up to thanks, and with going to bed with gratitude and request for protection. So there is another piece of time that is meaningful. That have helped those who have been wise in our tradition, I think, to count their days in the way that the psalmist had in mind. Now, when we think about these practices that have come to us in scripture and in tradition, the point is not to replicate what has gone before, to do exactly now what other generations did in different contexts. The point is to help these come alive in our own context, okay? Not in a rigid way, but in a way that is possible and helpful within our own context, and in a way which is not just to help us get order in our lives, but in a way which frees us for service to others and for all the other practices to which we've been called. And the context in which we live is a very difficult one, I think, for these. Right. Very difficult one for these. And I can see that I have vastly more than I'm going to be able to say. Let me figure out what I'm going to do. Let me say a little bit about the context and see if it resonates with you. My particular demographic group belongs to what we would call the overworked Americans. I'm using there the title of the book by Julia Shore. Okay, overworked Americans. There have been studies because of the sense of stress and fragmentation that exists, there are studies that do show that, yes, indeed, most American people and most who are employed, whether they are employed at the top of the wage scale or at the bottom of the wage scale, are working more hours outside the home and inside the home than they did a generation ago. Okay? You have to go way back to get more than what we are asked to do now. We live in a society that demands a lot of us. Okay? Even in our leisure time, we're supposed to work out, which I think is kind of somehow the labor-saving devices haven't quite done it. There's another category of Americans who are harder to name. A recent study challenged this idea that people are working so many more hours than they were before. They said it's mostly your demographic, Dorothy. It's not everyone. If you take the average, there is more. The people have more time than they did before. This is factoring in people living longer and having long retirements. Okay, but the extra time that American people have is almost all spent on television. If you take a time study of what people did a generation ago, how many hours they put in, you would find that anything that's been gained is spent on television. And so having more time is not necessarily equating to more faithful and full lives. I call that group the distracted Americans. And then I think we also would need to take note of underworked Americans, or people who are cast aside in the economy that asks too much of some people and that casts others aside. But there's anguish in all of these positions. There's anguish about the shape of time in all of these, the sense that we're being less than we can be. Two issues that I think are deeply embedded in the dilemmas that we have as North American culture, very briefly touched upon. One of them is the hold of the clock upon us. Okay, the hold of the clock upon us. There's a very funny scene in Gulliver's Travels where the Lilliputians ask Gulliver, what is that big thing hanging at your waist going tick-tock, tick-tock? And they figure it must be the god he worships, because he says he never does anything without consulting it. And the whole way in which the invention of the clock, the carrying of the watch, the strapping on of time, connects us up to worlds of transportation, of commerce, of entertainment, of work, makes possible the development of marketplaces, okay, beyond, and Gulliver's Travels written right as the world was industrializing. So that's a very important point. Time has been commercialized. Right? People bill by the minute in certain professions. You think about Ebenezer Scrooge, you know, who won't let what's-his-name go home because he has to work right up to the stroke of time. Right? Time has been commercialized, and this can invade every part of life. We've become, as a culture, I think, very time-conscious. A friend of mine who's a pastor told me about finding a bulletin in a pew on a Monday morning in which somebody had written down how many minutes and seconds each segment of the worship service had taken. You know, Old Testament reading 3.35, you know, hymn 4.01, you know, and she kind of thought, whoa. And it's very, my low point of the week for quite some time, we've kind of passed this as a family now, is when people start fidgeting when it's been about 59 minutes in church, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. The hold the clock has upon us. Mm-hmm. And some of us are starting to wonder whether we could leave our watches home. You know, Orthodox Jews leave their watches home on Sabbath. They do not carry watches on their Sabbath. Mm-hmm. Could we leave our watches home and just enter into what's going on? I think Susan invited us to that on Sunday night. If you were there for the Eucharist service, some of you may have come in since, the presiding minister knew it was going to be a long service, I'm sure, and she said, this is not chronos, this is not clock time, this is kairos. And could we do that as a little movement of liberation in our society? Secondly, another one that I think is a major trend in our society that is a problem for us as we think about how to practice Christian timekeeping in our society is this rush towards what's called the 24/7 society. You know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's kind of a youth culture word, 24/7. The tendency of things now to be open all night long, which is, you know, has to do, again, is a commercial movement, okay? But in the digital time of the World Wide Web, little digital clocks that are there on computers that are not really, they invite you into a marketplace that is not tied to nature, you know, not face-to-face and local, but rather one which encompasses the globe and never closes. And I think as we learn to live by this 24-hour time, where even day and night are hard to distinguish, it's a further remove from nature, it's a further remove from the joys and challenges of face-to-face community. It will change us as people if we live by that time. There's one quotation I just can't pass up by a poet, Noel Oxenhandler, who offered an image of this that I think is profound. She says, every town has two institutions lit by what she calls the same shrill 24-hour light, the doors that never shut, the windowless air, and a counter or front desk manned by the same rotation of pale clerks with their free-floating body clocks. These two institutions are the 7-Eleven and the emergency room, right? What does it mean that the 7-Eleven and the emergency room are atmospherically similar? The emergency room is the true domain of necessity, the place where there is no drawing back from the bleeding wound, the broken bone, the last minute contractions. But a Pop-Tart, a six-pack of Coke in the middle of the night? We have come to believe that convenience is necessity. What begins as slogan, words sprayed on the surface of things, billboards, labels, magazines, becomes visceral, and if we can't find it, we feel a knot of anxiety or frustration. We're thrown back on a world that has its own rhythms, that doesn't immediately bend to meet our yen, to eat a candy bar, or have a shirt pressed, or even our more serious needs. Our own definition of a world in order is one in which all goods and services are always immediately available. This is the aspect of the mall as paradise, and it is our version of eternity, seasonless, ever-present, abundant. It's a false vision. It's a false vision. It's a false promise. And as Oxenhandler says, it's one more step in the spreading of the zone where everything is the same, you know, and all time is the same. Almost done here. Now, so what can we do? I mean, I get you to think for this. Is great. There are these great resources in Christian tradition of thinking about the week, the day, and the year in ways that can form us in faith. And then there's this culture that just is rushing in another direction. What should we do? Well, now, we could become monastics, right? And keep Sabbath very rigidly, and we could pray the hours every day, and we could keep, you know, devote ourselves to the annual liturgies. And there are some people whose calling it is to do that, and I do think that the existence of communities like that is a real challenge to those of us who live in the world. But most of us do live in the world. So we could, especially when we're in the mood for evangelism, you know, try to cut our church services as short as possible in order that more people would come, you know, and have drive-in church, which I've heard exists. You read about this in magazines, I've never seen one. You know, drive-in church, 25 minutes max, located near the mall, you know, so that you can get a lot of things done on Sunday while you're out, right? Or we could find, I think, just as people in personal life think, if they just find the right little appointment book, or they just find the right software for the computer that will plan their schedules, you know, that the congregations often think, well, if we just figure out, maybe is 10:30 better than 10:45? You know, if we did Saturday night, would there be more people? There's little stopgap measures. So we can do that on the other hand. But I think what really needs to happen is for communities of people to support one another in thinking through this question in your own context. What are the impediments for you in particular in keeping Sabbath? What are the things that freedom from which would make a Sabbath for you? Okay. What are the things that you can do in your own community, rather than either a monastic move or a complete cave to the culture of time stress, be a matter of making some specific choices about specific things that would shape each person's day, shape each day, shape each week, and shape our year. That's returning to Bill Gates. Yes, practices like this will take time. That might not be very efficient from a resources management point of view. But practices like the ones that I'm just hinting at here also transform time. I mean, they take time and make it something different than it was before. Take time and show us something new about ourselves, about the world we live in, and the God we worship than time was before. Which is the point. It's not for the sake of our own sanity or mental health, though hopefully that's part of being in tune with God, but it's also for the sake of those whom we... it's for the sake of seeing through the false promises of them all. Okay? It's for the sake of becoming more available to serve others. Now, I'm wondering if you have... general comments, but also what kinds of stresses you experience in your own contexts with this, whether I'm the only person who has this problem, and whether what kinds of choices and shapings, you know, what kind of practices we can put into play that will help us to live more faithfully in the midst of this chaos of time that our culture is presenting to us.
I don't know, I only see frustration. I think that particularly, we don't have young children anymore, but particularly for families with young children, the amount of how sports is entering mm-hmm. into Sundays and mm-hmm. demanding, I mean, families aren't making the choice to
right.
worship with as a family. Children aren't learning the practice of worshiping on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
All these things are coming first. Games, uh-huh. little tournaments. And uh-huh. I don't know what to do about it.
Right. Does anybody know any community that's done something about that, or any congregation where some support has managed to emerge around people who face that kind of dilemma?
There are some small communities where there's enough of an enclave of Christian people mm-hmm. who are able to put pressure on the school, but
yeah.
they're not very common, and they're certainly not, they're not urban.
Right.
In our community, though, it's not the school that's doing it. It's outside of the school. There's all the mm-hmm. Little League this and mm-hmm. Olympic that and all the names, AAU this and... You know,
junior Olympics
or whatever, mm-hmm. it's all in the hands of the school as well.
The Wednesday night is kept open by a school district, you know, as being church night, you know, for confirmation and things.
yeah. Faith, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to comment. Our son-in-law is Turkish, and so we are in Turkey on occasion. And Our son-in-law has never owned a watch until he came to America, and his family said, "You're not going to America, you must have a watch," which he found out was very true, and he's learning very quickly, unfortunately, to live by it. But when we go to Turkey, and I'm afraid this is going to change now as more and more Americans find out the beauty of the country and the gentleness of the people, but we find out how long it takes us to sort of relax and do what we call the Turkish stroll, because nobody walks like we do, and so we have to slow down, and it's exhausting.
Yeah. Just one little tidbit from this book, A Geography of Time, which is so interesting. This guy wanted to find a way to measure the pace of life in different countries of the world. And so he chose a big city, certain time of day, not rush hour, how fast are people walking, you know, miles per hour. If you go into a post office and give the equivalent of a $5 bill and ask for the equivalent of a 32-cent stamp in that country, how long does it take to get it? And if you pick out 20 clocks in the downtown area, how close together are they set? You know, I mean, in Zurich, they're within 3 seconds. So it's really interesting. You know, he kind of rates all these different cities along the scale. We usually we're not right at the top, but some of the European countries are higher. But it's interesting.
Did he rate the northern part of the United States as opposed to the southern part?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But there's a homogenization gap. But that's interesting. Yeah.
What are the implications for America as we become more multicultural? And that means pluralistically in terms of religious faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or how you look at the concept of time and your day off. I mean, I'm thinking back even to the question of when you have your games, if you think Sabbath is a Saturday for one faith group and Sabbath is a Sunday for another faith group,
right,
and you're trying to be an inclusive community,
I'm not
sure what that leads you to conclusions around time.
Right. I think that's a great question. And for me, I mean, the way I think about that is that the world is not going to do my Christian faith for me. And it really never did. But some of us were, some cultural groups who felt like we were kind of in charge were seduced into thinking that just by being a good citizen in this nice Christian community, then I've done my Christian faith. And that was kind of how it was for a lot of middle class Protestants in much of American history. But in fact, I think that practicing our faith is going to be a minority movement now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to have to decide where, that's not to say that therefore, you know, all Christians must keep Sabbath exactly the same way I do. Not at all. I'm not going to try to be legalistic about it. I think that's contrary to the gospel. But I think we're going to have to make very discerning, specific choices about the shapes of our lives. It's not just given. And this may be a gift that this establishment has given to us. We have, as a family, been able to resist the Sunday sports teams. We have two kids, almost 13 years old. Now, they're not star athletes, and if they had been, I don't know if I'd be able to claim this. But my son's best friend is from a Christian Reform family, which is they're very strong Sabbath keepers, and that's been tremendously supportive. You know, to have a couple of families who just said, "No, we're not joining the traveling team. You know, that's not how we're going to spend our Sundays." And so I think it can be done. But I think that it is that we will have to really think about it and really decide where to draw the line for, you know, depending on the community and the circumstance.
So we need to teach parents or people the importance of using your time wisely and using it.
Yes. Yeah. Using
time for worship and for quiet time.
This whole question of using time as opposed to receiving as a gift is an interesting one too to me. I mean, is there partly what I hope that all this thinking can do is to help a culture that's very stressed out about time get some new words and some new ways of thinking about the problem of time that might put in a fresh perspective. You know, I mean, to try to turn it over a little bit from time management to what are our lives about anyway. You know, this is a gift. I also think that it's, you know, if even keeping these days and seasons and hours is mildly countercultural, I hope that it resists the culture in a way that pushes the culture towards justice and helps us to become people who are better in terms of our social responsibility and so on as well. And for me, not shopping on Sunday has become a symbol of that, of a kind of putting some distance between me and the consumer culture. And when my daughter and I had a conversation when she wanted to go to the mall with her friend on Sunday, and I said, no. We're just going to look. Well, do we need to always be looking? Do we need to always be building up these desires in our heart? No, that's not what we're to be doing. It's not, and that's a point that's not a Sunday point. That's a point. That's just a point for all week, right? But we wouldn't have had the conversation, at least in that context, without that, you know, that sense of there's some limits that are given to us that we don't have to just create. You know, they're given in the tradition.
Does Sabbath have to be Sunday? I guess I'm thinking about that because for some of us who work for the church,
right? Oh yeah,
we travel on Sunday.
Right.
My life is not ordered so that I can take that as so that the thing for me then becomes: do you find Sabbath someday out of the seven or in chunks of parts of days?
No, great question. I have two answers. One, I think that basically when I wrote this chapter, my object was to convince churches not to have meetings on Sundays. I don't care about costs of travel. I mean, I just think that Christian churches should not have business meetings on Sunday. That if there's anything that comes out of readings of the tradition about this, it's that, you know, making lists and planning money and all that is not what you do on that day of new freedom and new birth, okay? That's it. But, I mean, I'm not a legislator, but I think that that's something we could voluntarily take, and quite a few churches are moving in that direction. Say, okay. Secondly, though, even running a worship service is hard work.
Of course.
Okay. And I put those people who do that in the category of those who heal on the Sabbath. I mean, that they're helping Sabbath for others, you know, and even having people over on Sunday, which I try to do, but in a very simple way so that it's not laborious, is making Sabbath for others, which is part of the point, you know. So I think, though, that then some other pattern of rest is needed for those who do work for the church. But I think that if we just use Sabbath as any old time I take for myself, we're missing a lot of the implications that come from the biblical sources on it. And therefore, let's also talk about years and days. You know what I mean? We don't have to put all of our rest, renewal, and prayer into the topic of Sabbath. We can also put some of it into how do we keep a day? You know, how do we begin it and end it in a way that is right? What are the ways, the humble little liturgy of the hours that many families do? Prayer at meals, brief devotion in the morning, you know, bedtime prayer. It's a modest lay form of the liturgy of the hours. And it counts. It counts. You don't have to call it Sabbath. That's day. No, we've come to hold them, many of us probably, for renewal, rest, refreshment. We don't have to call this Sabbath. That happens on the day of new life for us now. This is a yearly pilgrimage, perhaps, as many people made. You know, over time. Is that helping? Hello, I hear someone.
This Sabbath-keeping and all the things that you've been talking about requires that there is a community.
Yes.
And if you don't have this community, it's very hard to have Sabbath for yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can have this thing, and maybe you come up with a ritual, or you say, one day of the week is my day of rest and whatnot. But it is individualistic. It is not based on this community consensus. Mm-hmm. That we make this particular seventh day is our Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So where do we find that community? Because our modern way of life destroys community. We just have this homogeneous marketplace here. And the communities that have been there traditionally, like our church communities, many of these communities don't make sense to people anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I come to this as, you know, a member of the church, and therefore want to say the churches need to think real hard about how to make more sense. You know, and part of it is not hitting everybody when they first come in with, here's what committee you can do, what committee you can do, and stay after for a business meeting, and so on. You know, I mean, I think that's part of it. But I think that in general, churches need to be thinking about what we have to offer, and doing it clearly and helpfully. And I see from my watch that the time is up. I have a covenant to keep here to end on time. I'm happy to stay. But tape guy, you can turn off. Or Tracy, you can turn off the tape.
I'm bothered by the what in our churches don't make sense. Amen. That, I mean...